A hospital encounter, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the auctioneer. So, you go to the hospital for a serious, life-threatening health situation, and it's like a fast food restaurant. But instead of asking you, would you like fries with that? The question is, would you like a staph infection with that? Except, no one really asks you that question, and no one really tells you that you have one. They wait until you go home, until you figure out that the IV site on your wrist, you remember, the site where the young nurse who clearly demonstrated poor insertion technique nearly caused you to hit the ceiling? Yeah, that. It's now red, inflamed, hot, pus-filled. That. Which now causes you to take 10 days of an antibiotic that brings along its own host of potential side effects. Should that really be the way to supersize your hospital experience? Today, I'm going to recount my mom's most recent pre-holiday hospital visit through the eyes of me, an informed patient advocate. Not because I want to, but because, darn it, as much as I was hoping that things would have improved since her last go-round, the experience was just as mind-blowing as all the previous ones. Nothing seems to be improving, and I can't for the life of me figure out why. Why is it so impossible for intelligent people to simply get things right? That's all. I just want things to be right. For people to be straight up, to be honest, to be precise. Since after all, we're not talking about serving fast food through a drive-through window, but rather serving human beings in their most frail and distressed time. A time when an error could possibly end a life. Let me begin at the beginning. Because of the rash of medical mistakes made back in 2008 when my mom entered the hospital for a total reverse shoulder replacement and was having a heart attack post-surgery, well, actually, probably pre-surgery or during surgery, that went unnoticed for 9 hours, even though the 4 EKGs taken throughout the day clearly stated in English, acute myocardial infarction in progress, she now has been managing heart failure all these years. Last year, she suddenly had extreme difficulty breathing, couldn't speak 2 words without coughing, feet swelled, which led to an outpatient procedure called thoracentesis. Thoracentesis is a procedure to remove excess fluid in the space between the lungs and the chest wall. This space is called the pleural space. Now, normally, the pleural space is filled with a small amount of fluid, maybe about 4 teaspoons full. Some conditions, such as heart failure, lung infections, and tumors, can cause more fluid to build up. And when this happens, it's called pleural effusion. A lot of extra fluid can press on the lungs, making it hard to breathe. Well, that procedure gave her immediate relief for over a year. But a few weeks ago, it happened again. So she called her pulmonologist to make an appointment. The gal answering the phone told her, "Oh no, today we are overbooked. So many people. How about next week?" To which my mom answered, no, can't wait that long. "Okay then, be here at 1 o'clock, but expect a very long wait." So I picked up my mom, brought a snack, some water, grabbed the wheelchair, and I figured we were in for a long day. As I opened the waiting room door and pushed mom in, we were shocked to find the entire room empty. No one was there. Were we at the right place? We checked in with the receptionist, and in less than 3 minutes, were called into the exam room. While we waited, Mom had to use the bathroom, and I sat with the exam room door open and watched the previous patient walk out, and I heard her thank the doctor, "Thanks so much for squeezing me in today." Okay, didn't look like much squeezing went on. The waiting room was void of people, and now Mom and I were the only two left in the office. And I wondered, why? Oh, why would they pretend they were swamped, warning patients of a long wait, talking about their grand gestures of squeezing you in, when in fact one could clearly see that no one was there? Once you realize that people are, pardon my French, BSing you, how or why would you believe anything they say? Which takes me to my next story. The pulmonologist nurse entered the exam room, took my mom's blood pressure, and stuck the pulse oximeter on her finger. And let me digress for just a moment because I find this to be interesting and I think you will too. You've probably wondered what and how that little thing works that the nurse clips on your finger during an exam. It's called a pulse oximeter, and it's especially used for people with COPD, asthma, congestive heart failure, to measure the oxygen level in the blood, and it detects heart rate. Now, I often wondered how it could detect oxygen levels in blood without actually drawing blood. A finger pulse oximeter functions by shining light through your finger. The sensors detect how much oxygen is in your blood based on the way the light passes through your finger. It calculates the results and displays a number on the oximeter screen that tells you the percent of oxygen in your blood, which ideally should be 100. A finger pulse oximeter also measures your pulse rate. How's that for cool? Well, anyway, back to the story. So the nurse clipped on the pulse ox, got a reading in the low 90s with a pulse of 78. When the doctor came in, he listened to mom's lungs and heart and announced that her heart rate was 150, and we had to go across the street to the emergency room right now. Well, I asked him, how could it go from 78 from the pulse ox taken 30 seconds ago to 150? And he told me that the pulse ox was not always accurate. Looking back, perhaps he could have explained that there is a difference between the atrial rate and the pulse rate. How helpful it would have been had he taken a moment to explain. If the heart rate is close to 150 beats per minute or higher, it is a condition known as supraventricular tachycardia, in which case the heart's electrical system, which controls the heart's rate, is out of what's called normal sinus rhythm. And this generally requires medical attention. But he never told us this. He just seemed to shove us out of the office and in a hurry. Maybe because they were expecting a crowded waiting room? We entered the emergency room Monday at 1:30. Jam-packed, full to capacity. Patients lined up waiting in the hallway. Since mom's case was more emergent than a twisted ankle or a fractured rib, we were given a room. People bustled in and out. Really, really nice folks, running tests, poking, prodding, talking, until about 7 at night or so, until they finally admitted her as an inpatient. That is a long time, hanging out in an emergency room. And just by the way, I brought my microwave radiation detection meter with me, and the high levels of electromagnetic frequencies given off by the cell tower on the property right next to the hospital, as well as the rolling carts that house the wireless computers, as well as the wireless router and everyone's cell phones, the levels were off the chart, making it difficult for anyone to survive very long in that kind of atmosphere. But that's another topic for another time. Now here's something I found a bit irritating. The gal in charge of admissions came in with her rolling wireless computer cart and began to ask the typical questions. Your name, date of birth, address, and so on. Now this soon led to some interesting line of questioning. She asked my mom, what are some of the things you enjoy doing? What is your best memory of doing that? What do you usually do on weekends? What three things make you happy? What is your goal for this hospital stay? Oh my, seriously? What three things make you happy? What is your goal for this hospital stay? I mean, I get the rationale, try to make the patient feel like they are a person, make them feel that someone is interested. But it was clear that this gal wasn't interested, as she responded, oh, okay, and typed head down into the computer. Is it just me? But what do these types of questions really have to do with anything? My goal for the hospital stay is to get the heck out, alive and well. I wonder, what do other people say? The goal of my hospital stay, let me see, to find a hot doctor to marry? To get a hot meal? At the time, I felt placated, and it didn't feel good. So note to hospitals, get rid of the supposed warm and fuzzy questions. No one cares. The patient knows it, and it's a waste of time. So after a long line of silly questions, the admitting gal said, the kitchen is closing soon, you might want to order dinner. No mention about a cardiac diet, a no-salt or low-salt diet, just order dinner. Which we did, and it arrived about an hour before Mom got to her room. Talk about a rubber grilled cheese sandwich and icy tomato soup. Yum. But more about the importance of the kitchen and dietary department in a moment. Now the room was the size of a minute, And it was a shared room. Mom asked for a private room, to which they said, no can do. But we will give you bed B next to the window, which was also right next to the only sink in the room, and I mean right next to the sink, as well as next to the only bathroom in the room. Well, luckily no one was in bed A, so we were alone for a while. And as usual, I entered the room like hazmat. The transporter wheeled Mom into the room, and I meantime donned a pair of gloves found on the windowsill and grabbed the disinfecting wipes and began to methodically and meticulously clean everything. The tray table, the bed rails, the phone, TV remote, the sink, the chair I was going to sit in, the doorknobs, the grab bars in the bathroom, the toilet, the flush handle. I must have used half a container that first day. And I did this every time I was in the room, just to be sure she didn't get an infection. I even washed her silverware prior to her using them. But whoa. What happened next caused us to pause. The next day, a patient claimed bed A, and whenever she had to use the bathroom, she would flush, then shuffle, past Mom, back to her bed, never washing her hands. My mom, being a loyal listener to this program, kindly suggested that she wash her hands. The lady did, not very well, and only when she thought Mom was paying attention. In addition, this gal would have visitors, loud, boisterous TV-blaring visitors, until 10 each night. Great for healing, right? And speaking of healing, sleep. It's an essential component to healing, right? We all know that. And a hospital is a notoriously noisy place. And that is why I found this next scenario quite odd. When bed A, the non-hand washer noisy guest gal, eventually left, another elderly woman landed in bed A. At the time, I didn't know she had Alzheimer's or some level of dementia. I didn't know this until she started yelling about having to go to the bathroom, even though she was on a catheter. If she shouted once, she shouted 100 times, please let me go. Please let me go. Please let me go. I peeked over to try to calm her and found her ripping off her hospital gown along with her heart monitor and other tubes and wires. I called for help and watched some random nurse in the hallway pop in and begin to ask this woman questions as if she were to know the answers. Do you know where you are? Do you know what day it is? The patient just screamed, please let me go. Excuse me, nurse, she wants to go to the bathroom. Oh, let me find someone, she said. The woman continued the yelling until another nurse entered, again asking odd questions, and I wondered, why don't they put some sort of sign on the outside of the door as they do for patients prone to falls? You know, like the fall leaf on the outside of the door? It looks pretty, but it's a signal to those in the know that the person inside the room is at a risk for falls. Why keep everyone in the dark as to the cognitive ability or disability of the patient in the room? Why waste valuable time asking a patient who has to use the bathroom if she knows where she is? And here's where it became even more ridiculous. There was some sort of IV placed on this woman's inner elbow that needed to always be held perfectly straight. If the arm was bent, an alarm went off that couldn't be muted by itself, but rather required a nurse to physically enter the room to manually turn it off. 2 seconds later, the woman bent her arm and the alarm went off. And this happened all day and all night, leaving my mom with absolutely no sleep. It's hard enough to get a nurse to come to your room on a good day. Why, oh why would they expect a person with memory issues to remember to keep their arm perfectly straight? Not gonna happen, folks. Isn't there another location on the leg, maybe, to attach this port? So my mom had to suffer, up all night, no sleep, agitated and annoyed and fatigued by alarms. Not the way to heal. And another case against shared rooms. Well, when this sad lady eventually left, another gal landed in bed A. Only this time, for some reason, maybe she was on diuretics, water pills, she used the bathroom every 4 minutes and never washed. Flush, shuffle back to bed. Flush, shuffle back to bed. I swear she did the flush and shuffle hundreds of times each day and never washed her hands. Again, not until Mom suggested that she do so. So my question, what are the infection rate numbers in rooms with roommates compared to private rooms? Well, I don't think you need any kind of a study to answer that question. But in case you do, This is just one of many studies that give credit to the obvious. One study led by the infectious disease expert Dr. Dick Zoutman from Queen's University says the chance of acquiring serious infections like C. diff rises with the addition of every hospital roommate. Each time you get a new roommate, your risk of acquiring these serious infections increases by 10%. And that's a substantial risk, particularly for long hospital stays when you can expect to have many different roommates. At Bronson Methodist Hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which built a new all-private room hospital in 2000 with hand-washing stations in each room, a study showed a 45% decline in infection rates in the new hospital compared with an older facility with semi-private rooms that it closed after the new one was completed. The private rooms required more space per patient and cost more to build, but savings in operational costs from the reduced infection rates offset the initial capital expense, the hospital says. Richard Van Enck, the epidemiologist at Bronson and co-author of the study, also says new federal privacy regulations are almost impossible to enforce in shared rooms where every consultation with a doctor or nurse can possibly be overheard. If I were ill and dealing with a disease, I can't imagine wanting a complete stranger sharing that experience, he says. Other studies question the lack of human connection in a private room, and I say hogwash. A hospital patient is not there to make connections. They want to be safe and get out without harm. Well, I asked the care coordinator and the nurses about the possibility of getting a private room. The nurses said, no, we don't have any. And the very kind care coordinator told me they had two rooms, and if we wanted, we could have one. Well, I nearly jumped for joy until she told me that the two rooms were designated infectious disease rooms. Oh, don't worry, she said. They are cleaned with some kind of bright light thing. Well, I'm sure she was talking about the use of a combination of chemicals and UV light. Typically, a portable UV irradiating machine is brought into the room. The staff opens the doors to the bathroom, and rolls the machine into the center of the room. UV light works through reflective properties, killing organisms even in the shadows if there is space for the light to reflect. The light apparently disrupts the DNA of these germs and kills them. I wonder, though, is that 100% for sure? Well, I didn't feel comfortable putting my mom in a traditionally used infection room, so I asked her what she wanted to do. She voted, stay put. I agreed. I think it's quite clear that the physical design of a hospital and the patient rooms are essential components to minimize the risk of transmission of any infectious disease. And sure enough, my mom left the hospital with a staph infection. Could the germs from the non-hand-washing flush-and-shuffle patients perhaps have lingered on the shared sink, the sink right next to my mom's bed and chair? Perhaps a bacterium picked up by the IV nurse? I don't know, and no one could know for sure. But what I do know for sure is this should not be expected or a normal outcome. No one should go into the hospital and come out with a hospital-acquired infection. No one. And shared rooms should go the way of the dinosaur, extinct. Well, before I continue, in case you're just tuning in, you are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. And today I am retelling my mom's most recent hospital experience with the hopes of sharing the good, the bad, the ugly, and the auctioneer so that these things don't happen to you. Alrighty, now I am on to the cardiologist. Not my mom's regular cardiologist, but the one assigned to her during her hospital stay. The one who spoke at a tongue-twisting speed. Did you ever wonder, why do auctioneers talk so fast? They talk like that to hypnotize the bidders. And I believe this fast-talking cardiologist was a former auctioneer with the leftover habit of seeing how fast he could get in and out. Sold to the American. We went 3 days before anyone actually put a name to my mom's problem. Days before anyone uttered the words atrial flutter, indicating the abnormal rhythm of mom's heart. Everyone was running around treating her, but no one told us what they were treating her for. Each day, the auctioneer cardiologist would dash into the room, rush through some words, and leave, usually before I could see him. Finally, I had some kind but serious words with the charge nurse and asked for her to page him so we could speak face to face at a normal pace. And sure enough, he showed up and rattled off. "We need to put a tube down her throat and look at her heart and then shock her heart back into the rhythm. We'll set this up for tomorrow," and he proceeded to head toward the door. I pulled his reins a bit and said, "Whoa, Nelly, slow down and explain what you just said." And he actually spent about 10 minutes sharing cardiology 101, which is what I needed, what my mom needed. Now, grant you, not every patient wants to know all things, but at the very least, a patient and their advocate should be given the diagnosis in lay terms with the opportunity to indicate if they want more or less. We declined the transesophageal echocardiography and the cardioversion procedure and asked about the plan B. He talked a few minutes more and explained our options, risks, and rewards. Well, having this understanding created a sense of, yes, we have a plan. Prior to our chat, all we heard each morning was, "You have to stay another day. Maybe tomorrow you'll be discharged. Next day, maybe tomorrow." Well, now we knew why it most likely wouldn't be tomorrow or the next day. We knew that they were watching medication levels. We knew what level the new medication, Coumadin, a blood thinner, had to reach to be considered therapeutic and therefore somewhat safe to go home. Well, during our Cardiology 101, I asked him about the hospital diet because from experience, I knew that a high-sodium hospital diet was not indicated for my mom or anyone with heart failure. Back in 2008, they nearly killed her at the hospital by giving her a regular diet, and then as she began to retain fluid, they would use aquaphoresis to pump and pull the blood from her body, remove the fluid, and return the blood. The first time she lost 30 pounds of water weight in 2 days. Why aggravate heart failure needlessly by feeding the patient salty foods? And things didn't change this time around. No one put in an order for a low-salt diet, so the kitchen staff would ask, "Would you like ketchup? Barbecue sauce?" They'd send saltine crackers, tomato soup, salted butter. I myself called the kitchen on the third day because Mom was ordering tomato soup every day because it was actually tasty, which sent the red flag. Tasty equals salt. When the kitchen gal answered, I asked, "Can you help me? Is tomato soup indicated for someone on a low-salt diet?" "I don't know," she responded. "I just got here." "What? What did that mean?" I replied, "Can you find out for me, please?" To which she answered, "It's low-salt." Okay, obviously she didn't know and didn't choose to care. So I asked the question, whose job was it to know about Mom's diet and how that would affect her heart failure? "I don't know. And that is why I brought it up to the speedy cardiologist." Would you like to hear his answer? He brushed me off and he said, "I'm a heart doctor, not a dietitian." And with that, he said goodbye and trotted out. I kid you not. Mom and I looked at each other and shook our heads. Wow, I guess I was supposed to be impressed. Heart doctor, not a dietitian. Talk about treating the whole patient? Not. And this was clearly his mentality, as a few days later, while a nurse was walking my mom to the bathroom, she told Mom, "There's a swelling on your back. You should ask your doctor about it." So Mom did. When the "I'm a heart doctor, not a dietitian" came in, Mom asked, "Would you take a look at my back? A nurse said it is swollen." Again, "I'm a heart doctor, not a back doctor," and he refused to look at her back. Am I wrong to think this is wrong? When a patient expresses a concern, it shouldn't matter if you are a heart doctor, or a nurse, or an aide, or a transporter, a kitchen staffer, or a housekeeper. The concern should be acknowledged and then fed to the appropriate party for follow-up. But arrogance and brevity? I don't think so. And my final, "Okay, I'm done with this guy" scenario happened when on so many occasions, the hurried cardiologist told me and my mom, "When you were discharged on Coumadin, you have to have your levels checked on a regular basis. I want you to go on Thursday. Here's where the Coumadin clinic is located, and it's on a walk-in basis. You do not need an appointment. It takes 5 minutes. They draw blood, check the level, They call me and I will adjust the dose based upon the results. Cool. So when mom was discharged on the following Monday on Coumadin, she made plans to go on Thursday. An important appointment, because if the level is too high, she'd be at a risk for bleeding. Too low, a risk for a stroke. It's a tricky medication with a fine line between too much and too little, and it needs to be monitored, especially at first. Thursday, she heads to the clinic. Not a small task, given that she's fragile, on oxygen, needs a wheelchair, and the simple task of getting dressed or taking a shower and getting into a cold, windy winter car is a day's work. Surprise! The gal at the Coumadin clinic informs her, you need an appointment, and you need doctor's orders, neither of which do you have. Wow, really? That's not what Dr. Quickie told us. Yes, I know, replied the very sweet gal. He tells everyone that. And we've asked him and his staff not to tell patients just to walk in. Wow. That says to me, this wasn't a one-time accidental human error, misinformation, or miscommunication. This was mean, plain and simple, mean, unkind, and unreal. And I say that because otherwise I'd be forced to believe he was simply incompetent. How would a patient feel confident to trust that he had the capabilities to manage a delicate heart problem if he couldn't even remember that the clinic he specifically advised absolutely required an appointment? So now what? No appointment and no doctor's orders. Had to head home, and both mom and I started making phone calls to his office to ask him to write the order. His answering gal gave the typical obligatory, I'll give him the message. No callback and no order written. I called and called and finally had to get agitated to get a response. And get this response hours later. The gal said, oh, he can't write the order. You have to go back to your original cardiologist. Seriously? The discharge order clearly said to see Dr. Quickie in 2 weeks. So he was able to treat mom, prescribe Coumadin as a new medication, and instruct her to follow up with him, told her which Coumadin clinic to go to, but was unable to write the order to have her Coumadin level checked? Am I missing something here? So that led to a 3:30 in the afternoon call to mom's original cardiologist. I left a message, but got no reply. Friday morning early, back on the phone, and I managed to catch someone who again gave the typical obligatory response, I'll give him the message. No response. And the Coumadin clinic closed on Friday at noon, which would put us into the weekend without having her level checked for over a week. Another phone call from me, and another, and another, and another, with a final message. If my mom has a problem and bleeds to death, because no one will take 30 seconds and a keystroke to order this test, you will have a problem on your hands. Finally, at close to 11:30, I managed to be put through to her cardiologist who said, oh, I signed something earlier and Susie faxed it. Well, maybe he signed something and maybe Susie faxed something, but it had nothing to do with my mom. Because another phone call to the Coumadin clinic and the kind gal said, nope, I keep looking and nothing's come in. And before my conversation ended with this doctor, he felt it necessary to make this nasty side comment. Well, luckily, I only have 3 patients to worry about. I responded, look, I'm not trying to be a priority patient, but this is a priority and she is your patient. And I can't help that Dr. Quickie messed this up. Fortunate for us, the gal at the Coumadin clinic was a sweetheart and she offered to stay late just to accommodate my mom because she knew how important it was not to go an entire week as a new Coumadin patient without having her levels checked. This bizarre scenario really makes me concerned for patients who are elderly or might have some cognitive impairment or who don't have someone to assist them. No one in that shape could have navigated through this mess by themselves. And that is why people die. People are actually dying because of, I don't know what words to use. It's beyond human error. Because doctors are rushed or like to think they are rushed? Or is it some glorious vision of self-importance? Simply not caring, forgetfulness, ignorance, arrogance, lack of empathy? I really don't know. But I tell you this because it happens. It just happened to us, and therefore it can and will happen to you. And there was a plethora of other seemingly non-significant absences, which when added up, create more health hazards. Mom was in her hospital bed for a full week, and the only time the bed linens were changed was when she woke up in the middle of the night to find that the IV blood thinner caused her IV site to bleed all over her and the bed sheets. She only had one bath given to her that entire week. No one seemed to be concerned about moving her to avoid bed sores, a condition we conquered in 2008 when she had a whopping stage 4 pressure ulcer on her backside, a gaping hole the size of Texas that went straight to the bone. Because of that experience, I talked with the nurses upon admission about ordering physical therapy. Even the speedster cardiologist agreed about having therapy, although I'm sure he couldn't do anything about ordering that because he's a heart doctor, not a therapist. Each day I asked Mom, did anyone walk with you today? Did physical therapy come in? Nope. And it was only through kindness of some of the nurses and aides who took it upon themselves to get Mom up on occasion to take a stroll around the floor did anything resembling therapy occur. Yet upon discharge, the discharge nurse told me, physical therapy gave your mom the okay to go home. Again, seriously? They were never here. Oh yes, look at the whiteboard on the wall, she said. It says physical therapy gave her the okay to go home on Wednesday. Hello, it's Monday. 5 days later, old news on the whiteboard. Whatever. At that point, all we wanted to do was get out. But it will be interesting to review the bill. I'm sure we will find a physical therapy code each and every day. Now, I know it sounds like a lot of negativity, and it was. But I must also say that most everyone who helped us along the way, from the emergency room staff to the transporters to housekeepers, nurses, and aides, they were kind and caring and obviously wanting to do a good job. As a whole, there was more good than not. But the reality is, the things that were not good could have been game changers, could have caused more damage, even death. So it's those things that stand out. It's those things that need to be brought out into the open, to be exposed, talked about, so you as a patient or a provider can do something to stop it before more harm occurs. A hospital stay is challenging enough without worrying about things you don't even understand. A patient shouldn't fear for his or her life because the doctor wants to impress with credentials and fast-talking auctioneer medical jargon. Or a kitchen and dietary staff who won't take the time to help a patient whose diet affects treatment, or because physical therapy is lacking, or that no one takes ownership and accountable for patient bathing and linen changing, or the very real fact that patients and providers' brains and bodies are being zapped by high levels of pulsing microwave radiation 24/7, a situation that in reality very well may be contributing to the consistency of mistakes made in a hospital setting. I mean, how could the kitchen, 3 times a day, for 7 days, send meals that included missing items? Soup, but no salad. Sandwich, but no soup. Tea, but no sugar. Roll, but no butter. Butter, but no roll. Something mysterious is obviously going on within the brains of an entire group of people that no one could manage to serve a correct order out of 21 attempts. Heaven help us if that happens with medications. And certainly, no patient should be sent home with an obvious staph infection at the IV site. So what can you do to help this kind of problematic situation? The first thing I would suggest, because I always find that it helps soothe an already stressful encounter, is to behave with respect and speak with please and thank yous. Thank you for helping me and my mom. I need your help. I know you're really busy, but I'm confused. Can you please help me? People do want to help and appreciate being asked with understanding and respect. And secondly, be informed as you can. Initially, I found that every new nurse that tended to my mom seemed a bit irritated when I asked questions, as if I were questioning them. But when they came to understand that I was somewhat informed and actively seeking more knowledge and wanted to learn from their expertise, they were way more than happy to become the expert and spend time with me. It didn't hurt when I eventually mentioned that being the host of this radio program and handed them a card. It opened up amazing conversations that told me that many of these nurses were as confounded by doctor behavior as I. They acknowledged my concern for infections. We were on common ground, on the same page, instead of being adversaries. So I say that intelligent, informed, and a knowledge-seeking attitude helps to make friends. And once someone feels that you are friendly and a friend, they do what they can to accommodate. And that is why I always suggest that you bring a copy of my book with you to the hospital. Simply lay it on the tray table, and right there, visually, is your entree into a conversation that can build a mini relationship between you and your providers. If someone were to ask you, would you pay $20 to have a safer hospital experience? What would you say? Well, this is what I offer you. The book is at the website, speakupandstayalive.com, speakupandstayalive.com, or you can call me and order by phone, 440-725-5462, 440-725-5462. You know, it was interesting to watch what went on with the bed A ladies. Never once did I hear the patient or a family member ask one single question. Their doctors would fly in, listen to a heartbeat, rattle off 16 words, and fly out. I was on the other side of the contaminated privacy curtain wanting to say, wait, what about this? What about that? But no, no one asked, and no one told. And that is not right. Hospitals are all abuzz about the patient experience. Patient-centered care, relationship-centered care. Hello, it's not about the fake pre-admission questions about what makes me happy, what are my favorite memories. It's about competence first, coupled with good old-fashioned empathy. Here's what I'd like to say to all healthcare providers. If you don't have the time, the interest, or the capacity to take good care of me, of my mom, or any of your patients, please find another job. Let's put some action behind the word care in healthcare. I hope you can take the good, the bad, and the ugly of today's story and use it to your advantage during your next healthcare encounter. The title of this program is the title of this program for a reason. You have to speak up and stay alive. 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30,